Welcome back, students. We're looking at the Gospels of Jesus Christ. Last time we considered the three synoptics, as well as the Gospel of John. We considered what a gospel is as a literary genre, not just the term or the definition theologically. We've also considered that there's four portraits, four perspectives. They're not biographies, they're preachments. They're meant to elicit a response of faith with the claim that those who do will receive life and the promise of resurrection from the dead. We also considered J. Gresham Machen's struggles with doubt, the nature of liberalism, which separates then the effect of Christianity, saying that its effect of comfort and of nearness with God and of his presence is not dependent on whether the facts of the historical gospels are true or not. In fact, the things that are true are related to the experience of God, not related to the actual claims in words that those gospels give. And by now you've read chapters 1 and 2 of Christianity and Liberalism, which says that doctrine is essential to Christianity, and that these claims, when somebody says Christianity is, those claims are historical claims, and they can be examined with the historical documents. And Machen then proceeds on a fact-value union that history and faith cannot be separated from each other. Well, one of the best ways to consider the claims of Jesus is to look at the structure of the gospel itself. I'm talking about the book. The literary genre has a certain structure. And then we'll consider a broad picture of three ways to assess his claims. And so in a future lesson, we'll look at more of the claims of the literature and how we would assess whether the literature is accurate or historical. But right now, we're going to look at the claims of Jesus, which are related to it. They're not separate questions, but our focus is on the person of Jesus Christ himself. And if you've never considered Jesus Christ, maybe it's just not part of your family background. Maybe, you know, you have a religious background that would say, I should not believe in this person. Or maybe I should regard him in a certain way. I remember washing windows for a Jewish man once that claimed we don't believe in Jesus because he didn't want to be one of us anymore. And so maybe it's the kind of background like that. I don't know what your background is, but I'm inviting you during this session to take a fresh look at the claims of Jesus Christ and three ways of how those claims can be assessed. And then whether you do something personal with it or not is beyond the nature of this course, obviously, but it gives you that opportunity. Well, the Gospel of Mark and the Gospel of Matthew both have a structure where there's a pivot point at a conversation in Caesarea Philippi. Caesarea Philippi is named after Caesar, I think Caesar Tiberius, and it's in the far north of the country. So Jesus apparently was on, you might say, a retreat with his followers, and having them alone away from the crowds that used to press him so hard, he was able to talk more personally and confidentially with them. His question was, "Who do men say that I am?" And they responded by several ways that the crowds said about the nature of Jesus' identity. John the Baptist, others said Elijah, some even one of the prophets. And you can see this is something we do in our own day. We take public polls, right? You know, we want to know what people think about our candidates. So we go out and ask people on the street. And so this is kind of natural. Jesus said, well, what is the public poll saying about who I am, my identity? And of course, most of them are using categories that they know of religious or holy men. One of the prophets, somebody that carries the message of God authoritatively. God's words were put in the prophet's mouth and they spoke on behalf of God. Elijah was a unique prophet who never died, who could command fire from heaven and to consume his enemies, and who tested and pushed the prophets of Baal by saying, well, call out to your God and see if he answers by fire. and then called the people to quit waffling. The God who answered by fire, he is God. Serve him. And of course, John the Baptist had just shown up on the scene after 400 years of silence. The man that must have been wild looking. Hair, I think he had like Nazaritic vows like Samson would and Samuel. No razor should touch his head, and so his hair is long. He lives on locusts and wild honey. He grew up in the wilderness. I mean, talk about a wild man figure. And people came out in droves to hear this man's castigating message about the axe is at the foot of the tree, and he's about ready to winnow the wheat, you know, and the good trees will be brought, you know, safely. The bad trees will be cut down, and the grain will be brought into his barn, and the chaff burned. And it's time to repent and turn from your sins and prepare the way of the Lord. Make straight a highway for our God. Well, then Jesus asked, well, who do you say that I am? And Peter answered on behalf of the 12, you are the Christ. John or Matthew's gospel, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. The same thing that John's gospel says, I want you to believe. I want you to believe that this historical person, Jesus of Nazareth, is the Messiah that the Jews have expected. He is the Christ, which is Greek for Messiah. And even more, he is the Son of God. He is God. Well, that claim elicits a response from Jesus in Matthew's gospel. Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. Peter's ability to identify Jesus with categories that were not known at that time means he went outside his cultural context to identify this Jesus. To claim that he is God, the Son of God, that he is deity, as well as the Messiah, is to make claims that mere human could not make. And so these are the claims that we're assessing today. And then, remarkably, Jesus said, tell no one. Now, that strikes us as odd. I mean, here we're dealing with a candidate that is utterly unique. Let's tell everybody about him. And, of course, that is the way Christianity's acted for 2,000 years since the New Testament. Why wouldn't Peter and John and James and Andrew go out and tell everybody and the rest of the 12? It's odd. It's that big secret again in Mark. Why tell no one? Well, at that point, Jesus began to tell them something they didn't know yet, that he was going to suffer. In fact, Mark 8 puts it this way, he was stating the matter plainly, that he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again. Peter rebuked Jesus at that moment. He actually said, far be it from you, Lord. And Jesus said, get behind me, Satan, for you are not setting your mind on God's interest, but man's. Satan did not desire Jesus, you know, to go to the cross. Once he knew it was inevitable, of course, he made the best advantage of it. But this is interesting. Jesus began at this moment to tell them very plainly that he would suffer, be killed, and rise again. They did not understand him. In fact, he tells them this plainly 3 times, and the Gospels are clear, Luke even emphasizing in 3 different ways once, that their hearts were hardened, they were stubborn, that they did not understand what he was saying. And I think it's because they were so committed to the greatness of the kingdom and the prospects of reigning with Christ that they could not fathom. It was so outside the box, his defeat. It reminds me of Hansi, a girl in the Sudetenland in the Czech area, who was so enamored as part of the Hitler Youth that she would not believe Hitler was losing until the day that the Russians rolled into town. And of course, it nearly cost her life, at least if I remember the story right. And so there's something about the human being that's odd, about what we're able to believe and not believe. My pastor in the past had a master's in clinical psychology, and he would say people could go to a doctor's visit, hear something like terminal disease, you're going to die or something, and then go home and tell their siblings or their family members, he said, I'm going to be okay. That's psychologically possible, which is why the pastor encouraged people never go to the doctor alone. I think we trust ourselves too much. So here we have one of those instances of remarkableness. Jesus is playing, I'm going to go die. And they're like, no way, I don't believe it. Because they're so convinced, apparently, in his victory. So Jesus then broadens it and says, look, if anyone, that includes you who are listening to me, and he summoned the crowds, and you disciples who have always been with me, Peter and the rest, if anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. Those are two forms of humility. To deny yourself means to empty yourself of your identity, that your name means nothing and God's name means everything. Second, to take up your cross means you are willing to put the interests and the goods of others and of Christ and his kingdom first to such an extent you would die. Whether it's die daily or dying physically in reality. The two have to be in that order. Many people are willing to suffer a martyr's death or to do incredible amount of service for others if they receive credit somehow. Maybe they deny it. Oh, don't make a plaque in my name. I don't need this institution named after me. But something deep feels good, that they would feel empty if it was unnoticed, or maybe angry if it was attributed to somebody else. So the first humility is to empty yourself or make yourself of no reputation, as it says of Jesus in the King James and Philippians 2, and then humble yourself, putting others first. I'm the low man on the totem pole, even to the point of death, death on a cross. Jesus did this, and he said, okay, if you're going to follow me, this is how I act. I haven't gone around and declared to everybody, I'm the Son of God. That's not the humility that I'm about. In fact, he came in kind of clandestine, incognito. The prophet Isaiah says that no one would have recognized him. He didn't look any different than any other. And so he then tells, don't tell anybody of my identity. If they're going to know it, it'll be through revelation, apparently. After I rise from the dead, yes. And so he encourages his disciples, literally his followers, to do the same. Which, of course, that makes sense. If he charts a course and blazes a trail that way, if I'm following him, I do the same thing. Well, here's a couple lessons in this curious story. Number one, belief in Jesus should be questioned. You should not take offense if somebody were to ask you, who do you say Jesus is? Or what do you think about Jesus? And if you give a response back, I think he's a great man, I think he's a moral figure, I think he's an influencer, or I think he's this or that, or maybe worse, a cheat and a fraud, and or even, you know, something more significant. Whatever it is, you have a view of Jesus, just like we said atheists have a view about God. Unless, of course, you're just completely ignorant of this historical person. And if Jesus can ask his own followers who walked with him and think it's not offensive to question them, who do you say that I am? Why should we take offense if somebody were to ask us about our real view of Jesus Christ? And perhaps you've never been asked that in your life. What do I think about Jesus? The second thing I take from this story is that to understand his work, in other words, what he does, culminating in his cross especially, I must first understand his person, who he is. Jesus did not reveal what he was going to do until he first established who he is. In part, I'm speculating a bit, it might have confused. If he had told for all along that he was going to die, then that would have influenced their view of who he is, perhaps. He's a loser. He's going to be defeated. But he didn't do that. He let it get first established deep in their mind that he is the Son of God. And once that's established, first, he is the Christ, the Son of God. Then he revealed, and I'm going to die, which is unthinkable. Obviously, that's the reaction. It's unthinkable that the God of the universe is going to lose. It also reminds us that the death is going to be unique. And if the Bible makes claims about that death that are big claims, we shouldn't be surprised, because the Bible also makes big claims about the person who died. In fact, we would be surprised if such a significant person dying would not have a big effect. And the Bible says it does have a big effect. And so I'm going to talk about that effect next time. Hold that off. Today we're going to focus on the person and how we assess the claims that Jesus makes about himself. Holding off on what he does until next lecture. Well, let's look at the fundamental identity of Jesus Christ. He is Jesus. He is Christ. And then he's the Son of God, or the Son of David, and the Son of Abraham. The word Jesus, as I mentioned in a previous lesson, is Joshua in Hebrew. Jesus, or Jesus, is Greek, and it literally means he who saves, or salvation, Yeshua. And so, when he's given the name and the birth narrative in the very first chapter of the New Testament, it is said of him, he shall be named Jesus. Why? For he shall save his people from their sins. Now, that's quite an announcement by the angel to Joseph, who's going to be the stepdad in this situation. He shall save his people. And a boy, did they want some salvation. They have not had a free country, basically, other than for a brief time under Hasmonean kings in the 2nd century BC. And I don't think it was that dominant, but basically those four empires have dominated their existence. Those that Daniel had in the visions back there. Babylon, Greece, you know, Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome. And so to shake off the Roman rulers, I think, was a large part of the popular conception of the coming Messiah, that he would save us from the Romans. I think there's many people today that would love a Jesus that would save them from their personal problems at the current moment. To change their health, change their marriage, change their financial status, change something, save me. And do it in the here and the now. And yet, his name speaks of salvation from sins, not salvation from earthly situations. We need to hold that thought, remember that. In some way, like the auditor that told me in my engineering job, you know, you got to go to the root cause. And if we go all the way back to the third chapter of Genesis, the decision that cascaded mankind into death and doom was a decision to disobey the explicit command of God, which is the essence of sin, lawlessness. And if that was what started it all, then we need to go back to its source and address the sin problem. And that's what Jesus would save them from, their sins. Well, Christ is the word anointed, literally. Christ is a Greek word as well. It's the Greek word for Messiah or Mashiach, the anointed one. There were two main individuals anointed in the Old Testament, the king and the priest. Prophets, I guess, were sometimes anointed, but it's not highlighted. It's not the big thing. And so if I were to say, you know, what, based on the Old Testament context, which is the historical cultural context for these terms, what does Messiah refer to? Well, it points to the fact that this person is designated to be the next king. This person is designated to be the next priest. These two offices were separate in the Old Testament. Just as we see Moses led the people out of Egypt, and his brother Aaron was the high priest, Moses being the civil leader, Aaron being the religious leader. So in the monarchy, David is the king on his throne, but David is not a priest. No, he has, Zadok is his priest, I think, and and in his time period, and it's a new priestly line that replaced Eli, and so the two offices are separate. I mean, we have that, don't we, in our Constitution? We don't expect the Chief Justice of our Supreme Court to be president, nor to act like a president. We may talk about them legislating from the bench, but we find fault in that, because there's a sphere of authority given to the three branches of our government. So think of it like two branches of the government. The king is going to represent the reign of God to man. There's like a downward arrow on the king. God's authority is funneled through this individual and mediated through this individual to the enemies of God's people, which are the enemies of God. And the priest goes the opposite direction, up. So the priest represents the people to God and carries their sins and deals with their sins by means of sacrifice. A priest, in a sense, is like a trial lawyer, somebody to represent you in a court of law. The difference there is, of course, it's not based on being guilty. They're trying to prove you innocent. A priest actually assumes you're guilty and then offers a sacrifice in your behalf to remove the guilt. Doesn't deny you committed wrong. It actually acknowledges it and then provides a substitute life that will be taken in lieu of your life being taken. And so a king represents God to man, a priest represents man to God. One goes down, one goes up. The remarkable thing about Jesus, prophesied in the Old Testament, both in Psalm 110, to the psalm I had you read, I think the most quoted psalm in the New Testament. On the one hand, he's the king, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. And another, he's the priest. You are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. God tells his son, sit here. In the ancient world, nobody sat down unless they're a king, basically. People would lie down. Chairs were very rare. So it's a metonymy. To sit means to reign. And so sit here at my right hand, reign with me. And then eventually he's given his own throne later. And over here, he's the priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. Now, beyond being, that's an interesting name. I don't know if you'd ever name your son Melchizedek, or if somebody ever has. If you remember those four little verses in Genesis 14, which I'm not going to fault you if you didn't. It's just a little kind of blip on the screen. There's the king of Salem is also a priest of the Most High. And he comes out and greets Abraham with wine and bread. It's so hard not to see symbolism in all this. Because Salem is Jerusalem. It's ultimately going to be the capital where the temple is to meet God. Salem means peace in Hebrew, shalom. And he is the king of peace. But his name, Melchi, is king, and Tzedek is righteousness. So he's the king of righteousness and the king of peace. And the gospel will tell us that righteousness is given as a gift by God on the basis of Jesus' sacrifice. And through that righteousness being given, a man or a woman can have peace with God. And peace is established through the righteousness that has been given. And so the New Testament picks up on this imagery remarkably and emphasizes it. And so here's a priest, according to the order of Melchizedek. The only other time the Bible mentions Melchizedek is Psalm 110, before the New Testament picks up the theme. I say all that to say Melchizedek is both a king and a priest. And that's what Jesus is. The prophet Zechariah says he will be a priest on his throne, that the two offices will be joined together. That in this one person, we will have the answer to our enemies, the devil, his angels, the wicked, who have not bowed the knee to God and turned to his son. Someday they'll be destroyed in the great antithesis, in the heaven and hell of eternity. God's reign, God's authority is mediated through his son Jesus, this one individual. But this one individual also represents the sinfulness of God's people before God and deals with it by offering his own life on their behalf. So that everything man needs is in Jesus. The revelation of God, the resurrection from God, all these benefits and more are in this one person to such an extent that Paul says there is one mediator between God and men, the man Christ Jesus. One mediator. There's only one who is the king, the anointed king to represent God on earth. There's only one who is the anointed priest to represent man in heaven. And it's the same individual, Jesus. This is what makes all rivals wrong. And if anybody seeks to add to the mediatorial work of Jesus by adding other individuals, they then take away from the unique glory and the unique position of Jesus as the Christ, the anointed one. Or if they deny either of the two, either the king or the priest. I remember one liberal minister in a town where I was at, and it was a Methodist church, and he denied that God had wrath. He denied the need for life to be taken to make up for wrongdoing, for sin, for guilt. He just believed, as liberals do, that God is just love, is this great father figure, and we just need to recognize it and feel his warmth, feel his love. I believe God is love. And then John especially emphasizes that because God is love, he sent his own son and did not spare even his son to die in our place. God demonstrates his own love in that while we were yet sinners, Paul says, Christ died for us. And so, yeah, I believe God is love in giving his son. But I told the minister, it's like, I don't think you believe that Jesus then is the Christ, because the Christ speaks of him being not just king, but priest. And a priest, it's his job to offer sacrifices. That's what a priest is and does. So, you understand now, Jesus is the salvation from sins, and he is also the priest. Okay, and the king, he's the Christ. Well, son of David, son of Abraham, points back to those seed promises that we've been looking at. And the first verse in the New Testament announces that basically he's the seed of Abraham and the seed of David. The seed of David means he's going to have a throne, and it will be eternal. And Isaiah picks up the theme that he is the mighty God, the Prince of Peace, and of the increase of his government and of peace there shall be no end. And Isaiah 7 also says that he is God with us. So the Davidic king, the son of David that shall come someday, shall fulfill the covenant with David that his throne will be eternal by having a life that is eternal. I mean, whether it's priests have always had to be replaced, kings have always had to be replaced, but Jesus will never be replaced because he has an indestructible life. And a son of Abraham, if you remember back to Genesis 12, all the families of the earth shall be blessed in him. That's how Matthew starts, pointing to that legacy of Abraham, and it ends by Jesus saying, go into all the world, make disciples of all nations. And so Matthew extends his story from just the mere ministry of Jesus back to the point of Abraham, and in that is implied then blessing to all the families of the earth, which is an anti-prejudice message given to the Jews that he wrote to. And then at the end it says, I'll be with you always to the end of the age. It stretches then to his return and says, all the nations then shall be discipled in some way. Disciples shall be recruited from every ethnic group. And so the promises given to Abraham of a worldwide blessing is coming now in this individual Jesus. And the promises of eternal empire given to David are going to be now fulfilled in this one person, Jesus. Do you see how the very identity of Jesus brings with it remarkable claims? So let's look at those claims and how we should assess them. So in your notes, you'll see that I have arrows going to either direction from a bullseye in the middle called the Gospels. We can look to the past, we can look to the future, or we could look at the present, which in this case is the Gospels and the literature itself, the events that Jesus goes through. These are the three directions to look at and assess his claims. With regard to the present, it's the puzzle of his person. If all you had was just the Gospels, in other words, no church history, no Old Testament, just Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you would be left with an intriguing picture of an individual who on the one hand is amazingly humble. I mean, so much so that the liberals love it about Jesus being so humble, so caring for the poor, so compassionate when people are in need. And it's Christianity that's brought this kind of thing to the West. We were in a compassionate kind of, you know, holding up societies. Clemency was apparently what was the best that Western society did. But Christianity brought compassion as a value. And Jesus was so humble, he would take children into his arms to bless them. And his disciples were rebuking the parents. This is a very important man. He doesn't have time for your kids. But they didn't know their master. And we talked about the value of those who would take time for children. And so Jesus then is a remarkably humble individual. Others are always more important than him. He would stop whatever he was doing to meet a need, something I struggle with personally. I'm very task-oriented. It's hard to stop. But Jesus would do it. And yet, the claims that came out of his mouth are amazing. Your sins are forgiven. His enemies were like, only God can do that. This man is blaspheming. And Jesus said, well, that you may know that the Son of Man has authority to forgive sins, then he tells the paralytic, rise up and walk, which of course is not as hard and as difficult as the forgiving of sins. But he wanted to demonstrate with a sign that would point to the greater, saying, look, take my claim seriously. It's interesting in that story, he was willing to let the paralytic go home paralyzed, but with his sins forgiven. The forgiveness of sins is the root problem. It will eventually take care of all the rest. It is the most serious need that we have in order to achieve, resurrection. Well, other claims that he made are like in the Sermon on the Mount. I guess I didn't talk about the Sermon on the Mount, did I? I was going to do that. It's a sermon that has basically a simple structure. It announces with blessings who are going to the kingdom in a field guide of identifying them through the Beatitudes, through their being poor in spirit and mourning over their sin and national sinfulness, in being meek, in longing and hungering for righteousness, in being merciful and pure of heart and peacemaking and persecuted. Those are the ones that inherit the kingdom. And if your righteousness does not exceed that of the scribes and Pharisees, the most religious of the leaders of the time, then you are not going to heaven. Well, what were they doing? What was their righteousness? Jesus goes, here's what they say, and then he says, here's what they do. They said things that actually nullified the law. You have heard it said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you, he who looks on a woman has committed adultery in his heart. You've heard it said, you shall not commit murder. But I say to you, if you're angry with your brother without cause, you're guilty of hell. You have heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. I say to you, turn the other cheek. Do not resist him who is evil. So our righteousness must be better. Our standard of what is right must be better than what they were teaching and also what they were doing. They were offering prayers to be seen. They were giving money in the sight of others. They would fast and make sure everybody knew that they were fasting. Jesus said, do it in secret and your Father who sees you in secret will repay you. Well, at the end of the sermon, he basically says there's two ways, two roads, two destinations. A broad way and a wide gate that leads to destruction. Many of those are on it. A narrow way and a straight gate that leads to life. Few are those who find it. This is the antithesis. This is the hallmark of faithful preaching according to the Bible. You don't fool people into thinking that they're okay. Healing the brokenness of their people, of the people superficially, like the false prophets did in Jeremiah's day, saying peace, peace, when there is no peace. We don't want a Neville Chamberlain coming back to us saying peace in our times. We want a Winston Churchill that says there's a genuine danger here, and if we don't take it into account, we perish. That's the way Jesus was with his preaching. He was bold, but he even went farther. Because at the end of the sermon, he says, many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not cast out demons? Did we not prophesy in your name? Perform many miracles in your name? But Jesus said, not everyone who calls me Lord, Lord will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only he who does the will of my Father. And I will say to them, depart from me, I never knew you. Just as Jesus didn't act like a prophet, prophets would say, thus saith the Lord. Jesus says, truly, truly, I say to you. So in his judgment, he doesn't say God's going to judge you. He says, I'm going to judge you. I'm going to be the one that decides whether you go to heaven or whether you go to hell. I hold the keys of the kingdom. Those claims are stupendous claims. And it's the paradox, I called it the puzzle, of his person. Because this humble man is also then the one who makes such audacious claims. How can such exist together? It's this fact that led C.S. Lewis to respond so clearly with his liar, lunatic, Lord trichotomy. You have basically three options. You're going to respond and say, this Jesus must be a liar, in which case you impugn his moral character, which is hard to do in light of his humility and his conduct, or he's a lunatic, right? He doesn't know that he's not God. But then that's hard to square with the profundity of his statements and sermons and sayings, or else he's Lord. Listen to the way C.S. Lewis describes it in Mere Christianity. I'm trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That, Lewis writes, is the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic, on a level with the man who says he's a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. That's one of the best things Lewis ever wrote. It's a powerful statement of how the Gospels drive us to a decision. The paradox is real. And I believe that the true solution to that puzzle is to acknowledge his claims of deity and then to realize that the God who is a God who is profoundly gracious and merciful. That's what Moses discovered at the mountain after the golden calf experience. You are I am. I want to see your glory. And it was revealed to him, I will be, not just I will be what I will be, like I'm free, I'm going to do what I want, and I don't care about you. But I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious. I'll be merciful to whom I will be merciful. That I am slow to anger and abounding in loving kindness and truth, forgiving thousands. So that nature of God at the very core of his being is gracious and good. We can trust him. Yet by no means will I leave the guilty unpunished. He's slow to anger, but eventually punishment comes. Well, Jesus said, I manifested your name on earth. He tells his father that. And I believe he did. When he said, I am, and then I am the light of the world, and I am the way, the truth, and life. I am the resurrection and the life. I am everything you need. Well, Machen also highlights it, and I think you've already seen it in his writing. He calls it the messianic consciousness. He claims that the liberals cannot erase the messianic consciousness of Jesus from the Gospels. They're trying to find a Jesus behind the Gospels, but they're assuming, with naturalistic presuppositions, that it can't be a supernatural Jesus. So they try to scrub out the supernatural elements to kind of piece together a naturalistic picture of Jesus, a mere man Jesus. But Machen says you can't do it. It's like grandma's old knit sweater. You start pulling at that yarn, eventually the whole thing unravels. You got nothing left. The messianic consciousness is woven so deeply and tight. Jesus' own sense that he's different, that he's a unique I will say to you, right? Truly, truly, I say to you. Many will say to me on that day. You can't erase and scrub out that messianic consciousness of Jesus. It's part and parcel of the whole picture. Well, that's the one claim. If you look at just the Gospels, if you were to deny the deity of Christ, you would have to have an explanation of profound psychological subtlety to explain that person. Second, we can look at the future, the phenomenon of the church. Somehow how the church acts is related to their founder. Every movement has to have a founder. It's all traced back. And so Marxists resemble Karl Marx, who's a very strong revolutionary figure. In fact, he wanted revolution so that he could create the world. And that's been the characteristic of communism even to this day. And so the religion of Jesus Christ, the church or Christianity, is related profoundly to the person of Jesus Christ. And you can basically infer some things. For example, what made the disciples so bold after they have been cowering and fearful? If it's not seeing the resurrected Jesus and realizing the fulfillment of prophecies, some other explanation must come up with this profound change that these fishermen all of a sudden become national preachers, and the national leaders recognized them. They marveled. Where did they get such learning? And then they recognized they had been with Jesus. And yet, it's a movement of peace. It's bold. It faces any government and is willing to die, but it refuses to overthrow governments. As Jesus did not send his disciples out, saying to the governor, if my kingdom was of this world, my followers would be fighting, but my kingdom is not of this world. And so the true followers of Jesus Christ go meekly into the world, speaking boldly but willing to accept whatever punishment comes. And it has been a mark of the Church of Jesus Christ to be a martyred church that yet flourishes and doesn't retaliate. Without the person of Jesus Christ, how do you explain such? And without the resurrection, how do you explain such confidence and assurance of a future resurrection from the dead, making them willing again and again and again to be martyred for the name of their founder, Jesus Christ? It's also interesting that this Jewish man, Jesus, founded a transcultural movement. you look at the spread of Islam, it is very much related to Arab culture. Though it spreads to other regions and other areas, whether in Africa or Asia, it still retains a love for the Arabic and for the Quran, I understand. And so it is very much a religion tied to its cultural context. But Christianity breaches way beyond it. Not only like last time we saw using Greek, the language of a variety of people, but even culturally going to this day to very, very different peoples. How do you explain that if Jesus isn't God? How do you explain such power of ethnic flexibility, not making a monolithic, one-size-fits-all religion culturally? Well, third, you can also look to the past, and I think this is often forgotten. Christianity stands on two legs. One foot is the Old Testament, and one foot is the New Testament. And the New Testament is the Old Testament revealed, and the Old Testament is the New Testament concealed. I think that's a famous Augustine quote. But basically, promise and fulfillment make the two parts of the Bible match like a key and a lock. They just perfectly fit together. And so you can't isolate, ultimately, the Gospels or even the New Testament from the large literature of the Old Testament. And when you do bring in that Old Testament, it is amazing what you will see if you have eyes to see and ears to hear. I remember translating many of the Messianic Psalms and looking at the amazing way that the Psalms are fulfilled in detail by the person and work of Jesus Christ. In just remarkable ways. One half of the line says that they will gamble for his clothes. The other says they divide his garment. And at the foot of the cross, his two garments were treated differently. The outer garment was torn in pieces and given to the soldiers, but the inner one was woven of one cloth, and they didn't want to tear it, and so they gambled for it. It's that kind of precision. He was with the wicked in his death, but then buried with the rich. I think it's Isaiah 53, verse 9. And so Jesus was between criminals and yet was placed in a rich man's tomb, Joseph of Arimathea. It's interesting, reading Isaiah 53 reads like the gospel before the gospel was ever written, and it's 700 years before Christ came. And so, and this is just the tip of the iceberg. It's all throughout the Old Testament, both in sayings like that are predictions or promises, but in institutions like the king and the priest institution, or the temple and the tabernacle. And so Jesus fulfills everything. He said it's easier for heaven and earth to pass away than for one stroke of a letter of the Old Testament, the law, to fail. It'll all come to pass, down to its detail, was the confident message that he gave to the Old Testament. And so to me, the Old Testament was like a computer image where the pixels are put on one at a time. Genesis 3:15 might be the first pixel, you know, where the serpent gets crushed and such. And then as we go on, more prophecies, more promises, more institutions, more individuals, until finally all the pixels get added up to this face. It's a most wanted poster. And it's this face of the Messiah. And so the apostles came along with their portrait of Jesus, right? The events and the sayings of Jesus. And they said, look, look, this is the same individual. Look at these two pictures. This most wanted man, the man we've wanted the most, the Messiah, is Jesus. I'm telling you, believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Messiah. And believing, have life in his name. And so that's the detail that we look at. We're given the background in order to categorize him, to understand it. He's Jesus. He's Christ. He's King. He's priest. He's son of David, son of Abraham. And then, bam, the Christ event happens. And the Gospels say, look, and they present the facts. Here's Jesus. Okay. With those three dimensions, three directions, you have what you need to consider the claims of Jesus Christ. You can't do it on your own. Ultimately, it takes a work of God, as it did with Peter. Who do you say that I am? God himself alone knows his Son and must reveal him. But he reveals him through his words, the Gospels, and the witness of the apostles. And so, academically, what you do with this is one thing. Personally, I hope that you take these claims seriously. All right, continue your reading in Machen. I have some assignment from the Gospel of John. We're going to incorporate some of that in a future lesson, Lord willing. Thank you.